Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Safe to say, the Thanksgiving table is not the only place to find turkeys these days. The world economy is full of them, from stock market madness to the lack of jobs, and a crisis in Europe that proves debt will not take a holiday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Welcome to the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, November 24th. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. I'm Tess Vigeland. The leaders of the three biggest economies in the Eurozone met in the French city of Strasbourg today. The German chancellor and the French president held their first meeting with the new Italian prime minister. The three leaders are now under intense pressure to end the turmoil caused by the European debt crisis. They duly announced the bare bones of a new plan, but financial markets were not impressed, and the euro fell following the announcement. From the European desk in London, Stephen Beard has more.
The leaders say they're planning to change the treaties that govern the way the European Union is run. No details yet, but it's believed the idea is to force the 17 countries that use the euro to abide by strict budgetary rules and not run up big deficits. Critics were quick to point out this would not deal with the immediate crisis. Megan Green of Rubini Global Economics.
We need them to take actual measures in the next few weeks or months. And it could take about a year for a treaty change to be agreed.
Financial markets are pushing for a much quicker solution, for the European Central Bank to behave as the Federal Reserve has and print money to buy large amounts of government bonds. But Germany, Europe's economic superpower, opposes that, fearing inflation. Christian Schulz is with the Berenberg Bank in London.
What we need in Europe is really a trigger for Germany to budge on its opposition towards ECB intervention.
And he says that could be if Italy slides towards default.
And the ensuing market panic, if that happens, must trigger the intervention of the ECB.
In other words, he says, European politicians are so far behind the curve, it's the markets that will bring the crisis to a climax and an eventual resolution. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A bit of news from the telecom industry today. AT&T and T-Mobile withdrew their merger application with the Federal Communications Commission, though both companies said they do plan to go through with it eventually. With all the food and feasting associated with this day, it's probably no surprise that the hours leading up to it are considered the busiest grocery shopping time of the year. So much so that many stores that usually close at night are increasingly staying open 24 hours in the run-up to the big day. Marketplace's Gregory Warner checked out the scene at one of those stores in Philadelphia.
The Fresh Grocer is a supermarket chain in Philadelphia. It takes in 12% more revenue the week before Thanksgiving. So the owners open up the store for 24 hours on the night before.
Waking up all night.
Tom Hayworth is the acting manager, can of Red Bull in hand.
This is a long night for you.
Pretty much, yeah. Not used to working the overnights.
Sales were steady, he says, until 3 in the morning, and then nothing but the hum of floor polishers. Until a few minutes before 6 brought a rush of early risers.
It's the best time. It's not crowded.
To beat the crowds.
Can't stand crowds. Mm-mm.
Over in the canned goods aisle, I find Amanda Shivers. Her family decided they would do Thanksgiving potluck style this year, save her from all the cooking. Until last night, she realized all the things that they forgot to buy.
They forgot the pot crust. They forgot the gravy.
They forgot the gravy.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, Philadelphia is number one in the nation for the most money spent on canned gravy per shopper.
You want to know why?
Yeah.
Cut down on the fireballs and the homemade gravy.
Fireballs, she explains, are the hot, oily bubbles that splash out when you're making gravy. They burn the cook, and they leave lumps in the sauce.
Gotta be smooth, gotta be consistent. That's the most important thing, the consistency of the gravy.
Greg Robinson is, as we speak, stirring three giant vats of gravy in the kitchen behind the store. He's the hot foods manager. He pulled an all-nighter cooking 49 turkeys. But not every shopper is here for turkey or gravy. Timothy Hall came to buy dog food.
Because the corner stores of cat food, dog food is too high, so I have to come here. They're going to eat good this Thanksgiving.
So you're really here shopping for your pit bulls?
Basically.
And to beat the crowds. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Investors are gorging themselves on turkey instead of stocks today, but the rest of the world was open for business. We'll have details on the international markets when we do the numbers. And now on this Thanksgiving, we turn to the question of job creation. It is the number one economic issue in this country, yet no one seems to have figured out how to get companies to hire more people. Howard Schultz has brewed up an idea that he hopes can help. The Starbucks founder and CEO launched an effort this month called Create Jobs for USA. It's a micro-lending program aimed at helping small businesses bring on more employees. The money will come in part from Starbucks customers, who can now find $5 donation cards sitting near the coffee giant's cash registers. Howard Schultz, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you brought gourmet coffee to the masses. Now you want to be a banker. Square that circle for me.
I don't want to be a banker. What I'm trying to do more than anything else is use Starbucks scale for good. When I look at the landscape of 9% unemployment, almost double that in the Hispanic and African-American community, I believe that we can, at Starbucks, leverage the equity of our brand in a way that's quite unique. We will collect millions of dollars, and we will get it in the hands of the Opportunity Finance Network, which has a national organization of community-based loan organizations that will provide access to credit to small businesses, startup businesses that will be a catalyst for job creation at a time in America when, unfortunately, banks are not lending.
Explain for us how that dollar donated by one of your customers will end up helping create a job in a small business.
Well, I think there is evidence among small businesses that they're having problems getting access to credit that they've gotten before. And so when we examine what we could do, we uncovered the Opportunity Finance Network, which among their network is these organizations that are community-based, many in underserved communities across the country. We will provide millions of dollars to these organizations, and they will vet the companies that are trying to get access to credit, provide them with a low-interest loan, anywhere from $10,000 to $500,000, and 100% of all the donations will go to the cause. Starbucks will provide $5 million as a starter from our own foundation, and we'll absorb the cost of anything to do on the administration level.
So this is not a grant, it's an actual loan. So when the business pays back that loan, where does that money go? It goes back into the fund?
Exactly. And, Starbucks has been involved in microloans and microfinancing in emerging countries. And what we found is that 98% of those loans are paid back. And in fact, the Opportunity Finance Network has given us their own statistics, almost the exact same scenario, 97, 98% of those loans that they've been lending has actually been paid back.
According to the information that you've released, for every $3,000 donated through the program, a job will be created or maintained. Can you help us understand the math there? Because $3,000 doesn't sound like a lot to keep someone in a job.
Yes. For every dollar that we raise, the Opportunity Finance Network, or the OFN, is able to raise more equity and borrow against it. Hmm. So there's a multiplier of 7 times. We also learned that the number that equates to a job is $20,000. So the $3,000 that you quoted times 7 gives us the job that will be created and is sustainable.
What's your ultimate hope for this effort? Microlending has a bit of a mixed track record.
True.
Certainly a lot of success, but also some questions raised about it. What are you hoping to see at the very end?
Well, first off, we're setting up within Starbucks a small group of people that will be engaged in this process from the very beginning to ensure the fact that the concerns that you raised do not come to fruition. But in addition to that, we hope that we can create a message and a signal to other businesses and other corporations that we can't wait for Washington. We need to do our part. And also, I think after the first of the year, we'll be announcing partnerships whose companies have assets and complementary skills that will bring more reach, more awareness, and more money to this cause.
How confident are you that your public, your customers are going to step up to the plate here? I mean, there isn't a great track record for efforts like this where you kind of put out a jar, basically, and say, can you help out your fellow man?
I have optimism that this is a different moment in time where Americans are going to help Americans. There's millions of people who come through Starbucks every day, and I believe we've created the kind of proposition that they will trust and support.
And in closing, any chance I could convince you to make the pumpkin spice latte a year-round treat? Please?
Oh, that's funny. I'll consider that.
Howard Schultz, thank you.
Thank you.
And to that question of whether folks will actually donate, we stopped by a Starbucks here in L.A. and asked a few customers.
It was pretty inexpensive given what you pay for a coffee, so I'm not sure how effective it'll be, but I'm hoping that it will be effective.
And I would want to know more about how the program worked.
It's not a significant amount of money for most people, and it's for a good cause.
I think anything we can do to stimulate the economy is a good idea. If they asked me, I might consider it.
And apparently many of us have considered it. Starbucks reports it raised $1 million in donations in just the first 2 weeks of the program. Today, of course, is all about the big bird. But plenty of folks spend their free time looking for small birds, walking around with binoculars and a guidebook in hand. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 48 million Americans consider themselves birders. Former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is one of them, for what it's worth. But as you may have noticed, Paulson is no spring chicken. Neither, apparently, are many members of birding's premier organization, the Audubon Society. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill tells us how the group is trying to change that.
It's a crisp morning in Los Angeles, and I'm out searching, not for the noisy goldfinch or the soaring red-tailed hawk, but for something much rarer. Wait! Hush! There she is, a young birder.
Celeste Prince.
Okay, my apologies to all you David Attenborough fans out there. But Celeste Prince is exactly the sort of birder the Audubon Society is hoping to find. She's in her 30s and is a musician here in L.A. She looks the part, with long red hair and dressed for our hike in a stylish coat and boots. Prince seems really, truly into birdwatching.
I get made fun of a lot by my brothers for it. There's times when I'm chasing a mountain quail through the backyard and they're all looking at each other going, oh my gosh, what is happening right now?
Prince has her iPad with her, with an application that helps her ID birds and make bird sounds. Something that can be a bit problematic, especially when she demonstrates by playing the call of a Cooper's hawk. And so now are thousands of birds freaked out that they've just heard a hawk?
Yes.
Gary George has been birding for 20 plus years.
Now you'll see that it gets very quiet. Because Cooper's hawks actually eat birds.
Probably not the right bird to choose for this particular moment.
George is with California Audubon. He says Cooper's hawk style mistakes aside, new birders and their technology are welcome. Organizations need to keep appealing to new generations to stay relevant.
This isn't your grandmother's Audubon anymore.
David Yarnold is the president of the National Audubon Society. He says they're trying out the new image in California, using social media to attract new people.
A younger, more diverse audience to help us create the Audubon of the future. And it's already paying off enormously in California.
Over 300 people RSVP'd to an Audubon-sponsored party at an art gallery in Venice Beach. Most of the partiers aren't members. And says Grant Krisham, executive director of California Audubon, that's not what this event, or even this rebrand, is about.
For Audubon, it's not so much about building membership per se. For us, it's really about finding ways to connect people with the work we do, but also connecting people with each other.
He's hoping people will connect over an interest in nature, and maybe even get out and do something about it. his timing seems good. If you think about it, there are already a whole lot of younger people who are trying out other, older generation pastimes. Once fuddy-duddy hobbies like knitting and canning are cool, why not birding? USC marketing professor Ira Kolb says the pull to simpler things, especially for young adults, makes sense.
Yeah, we're all going crazy by doing too many things. You know, the computer is going and the emails are coming in.
Kalp thinks that need for calm could work in Audubon's favor as it tries to make birding and the outdoors appealing to a younger crowd. But there's a bit of a risk.
You don't want to alienate your most loyal customers. And that might be the grandmas or the grandpas.
The trick is finding the right message that'll bring everyone in. So what do the birds think of all the fuss? I tried to ask, but they were too freaked out by the Cooper's hawk sound to make a peep. Maybe next time. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, to make from scratch or not to make from scratch? That is the question.
I would definitely make your pie crust. I would definitely make the pumpkin pie. But I did a test between pumpkin from a pumpkin and pumpkin from a can, and I'm all for the can.
But first, let's do the numbers. I think we can all be thankful U.S. markets had the day off today, but investors elsewhere in the world were not too grateful for the continued uncertainty in the European debt crisis. The Fitch Rating Agency set traders on edge, downgrading Portuguese bonds to junk status. The German DAX dropped 0.5%. The British FTSE fell 0.25%. In Paris, the CAC 40 lost 0.2%. In Asia, the Nikkei index shed nearly 2%. In Hong Kong, the Hang Seng index rose nearly 0.5%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. It's the start of the holiday shopping season, and millions are expected to turn out for Black Friday this year. On tomorrow's date in 1947, the Hollywood Ten were blacklisted for refusing to testify about alleged communist activities. And here's to you, Joe DiMaggio. The baseball legend was born on November 25th in 1914. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. At some point today, the Thanksgiving table conversation may turn to the state of our national finances and what that means to our family finances. This week, we invited authors to share how they're writing about the economy. Here's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson.
I go about writing about work by looking at the hearts and desires of the people who are attempting to fulfill their own dreams for themselves, but then also of taking care of their families. And so I view it as a people-centered way of understanding perhaps the economy and of whatever crisis we're in. And I spent 15 years and interviewed over 1,200 people who had survived the Great Depression. These were children in the Great Depression. These were people who were raising families during the Great Depression. And so I tend to take the long view when it comes to how people survive economic crisis. And it's given me a sense of, in some ways, faith and in a way, confidence in the ability of people to remake themselves and to adjust and find ways to survive the worst of times. And I think there's a lot that can be learned from that. I find that in times of economic crisis, though, the insecurity and the anxieties can still be there. And I just have learned to have great regard for people's abilities to find ways to make it somehow. And even if it means to adjust their own dreams in the short term so that they can get through those hard times. I think that there are great lessons to learn from the compressions that are forced upon us when we have an economic crisis.
Isabel Wilkerson's newest book is called The Warmth of Other Suns. Your thoughts? Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. And now a little something for all you marvelous cooks who spent the day in the kitchen. Shortly after the economy imploded, Jennifer Reese decided to cook everything she and her family ate from scratch and compare the cost to what she could buy at a supermarket. I visited her home near San Francisco back in 2009 to get a firsthand look and taste. The result of her experiment is a new book called Make the Bread, Buy the Butter, What You Should and Shouldn't Cook from Scratch. Jennifer, good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
So I visited your home up there in San Francisco a couple of years ago, and you had basically converted it into kind of a headquarters for your cooking everything from scratch experiment. Let's listen to a clip from that day.
I thought everything everyone did in a factory was going to be cheaper, and it was sort of this fake economy around being crunchy and homespun, but it actually turns out to be almost true that you can save money by doing things at home.
Almost true. So has that held up as you have put together this cookbook?
Yes, it has. You can save so much money by cooking at home. I mean, not across the boards, not everything, but many, many items of food you can save money by doing it yourself.
Well, of course, the title of the book is Make the Bread, Buy the Butter. And we talked at that time about why that was, that the cost-benefit analysis was in favor of going ahead and buying that pat of butter. Was there anything as you went through this experiment that surprised you?
Yeah, there were a lot of really weird foods that you wouldn't expect to be cheaper to buy that were. Like, I thought, oh, if I had the energy, I would always make my own lemonade, and that would be really frugal. But in fact, it costs about twice as much to make lemonade from real lemons
really?
As it does to go to the store.
Even here in California where, you know, citrus is a bargain.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a lemon tree, it's probably cheaper.
Right.
But if you have to buy your lemons... And it also takes a while to squeeze them. And then silly things like candied ginger. I was really into candying my ginger.
Right.
And it costs more to do it yourself, just slightly more, but more. And so I would never do it again.
You even went so far as to price out making your own prosciutto. Now, I don't know that I would go that far as to go find some raw pork and season it for myself.
Yeah.
But
and the prosciutto is a funny example because I did do it and it did work. And it was the most horrifying thing when it came out of its cure. It was like covered with mold.
Cool.
And in the end, I threw most of it away. So
yeah. So you'll be buying that from now on.
Yes. By the slice without the mold.
Well, part of the reason that I came up to visit you a couple of years ago was because there had been a spate of news stories about people raising chickens in their own backyards.
Mm-hmm.
And I had real questions about the financial wisdom of making mm-hmm. those kinds of moves. What is your conclusion at this point?
I think that if you have the infrastructure, if you have a coop and you have a proper fence that no dogs can see through, it's not that expensive to keep chickens day to day. If you have to put in the infrastructure, which most of us do, it can be outrageously expensive in the end. I had to build a fence for my chickens, and that was a $3,000 fence. And so I don't think you will necessarily save money if you get chickens.
And beyond the chickens? I mean,
I have goats now.
Oh, you have goats now?
I have goats. I have three goats.
Wow.
That is another thing that, you know, I've probably gotten $25 worth of milk out of them, and one of the goats cost $100.
Whoa.
I don't regret it. But the truth is that the ways you can save money are buying your spices in bulk and grinding them at home, making your muffins instead of going to Starbucks. It's simple things, not the more glamorous things like getting chickens, if you think getting chickens is glamorous.
Which sounds like you would argue it is not.
It sort of is, but sort of not.
So this book is really about making it so that people don't have to make this dollar calculation. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, at a certain point, I suppose you've probably found that it's not all about dollars anyway.
No. You learn how to make something and you realize how much better it is than what you buy. And so even if it costs a little more, which it usually doesn't, you'll end up making it because the quality of what you eat and therefore the quality of your life is enhanced by doing it.
Right.
In terms of the morality, one of the reasons we do have chickens now is that it makes my skin crawl to buy supermarket eggs.
And that is because of the conditions that you worry
yeah.
about the chickens being in?
It's not all about cost.
Well, today, of course, is one of the biggest cooking days of the year. So what about the economics of Thanksgiving dinner? What would have been best made today and what should we have bought?
All right. Well, first of all, do not raise your own turkeys. That is not fun to slaughter your own turkeys, which I did once and won't do again. I would definitely make your pie crust. I would definitely make the pumpkin pie. But I did a test between pumpkin from a pumpkin and pumpkin from a can, uh-huh. and I'm all for the can. Stuffing, you know, homemade stuffing is better. But I do have a sentimental attachment to Pepperidge Farm because that's what I grew up with.
And would you make your own Beaujolais Nouveau?
No. My basement isn't big enough.
No. Jennifer Reese is the author of Make the Bread by the Butter. She is also known as the Tipsy Baker. Thanks so much and good luck with the book.
Thanks, Tess.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you are among those Americans who wish Thanksgiving Day would keep being about Thanksgiving and not shopping, take a look at a proposal on the op-ed pages of today's New York Times. Cornell economics professor Robert Frank offers a policy suggestion that has about as much chance of passing as your turkey had of living to a ripe old age. But it's still worth a mention. Frank calls it his 666 plan. He suggests a 6% across-the-board national sales tax on all purchases made between 6 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day and 6 a.m. on the following Friday. Show of hands, please, if you are in favor. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Markets are closed for the Thanksgiving holiday today. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, Celeste Wesson, and Loretta Williams are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the broadcast, an argument for all of us to embrace Black Friday.
We know that consumer spending does drive growth, so why don't we learn how to accept, embrace consumer culture?
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.